Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org, soon to be 103.3 WSFM LP in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, on KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, and on KOWA LP in Olympia, Washington. Archives of the show can be found at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, podcasting at radio4all.net, and we invite comment on the program to be sent to thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. This week we're featuring John Zerzan reading a statement by Sean Swain, anarchist prisoner in solitary and being denied access to email and phone privileges for coming onto this show and just as he got a new lawyer. Also, we'll be revisiting a conversation with Will Munger, an editor of the AK Press Release 2013, Life During Wartime. We talked in that conversation about the application of counterinsurgency practice by law enforcement domestically in the U.S. and what it looks like in its varying forms. Sean Swain is on his 14th day of refusing meals, unofficially, until his phone and email privileges are turned back on, so that he can resume his legal defense, check in with family and friends, and record segments for this show. Sean only normally gets one 15-minute phone call a week. If you'd like to hear Sean's voice again, you can give a call to ODRC Director Gary Moore at 614-752-1150. That's 614-752-1150. And you can ask Mr. Moore to resume Sean Swain's email and phone privileges.
This is John Zerzan reading a statement by anarchist prisoner Sean Swain. April 28th marked the 23rd anniversary of my arrest. It's my 8,168th day of continuous captivity for a crime I probably did not commit. My case. Back in 1991, I shared an apartment with Diane Cisneros and her two children from prior relationships. Andrew Crouch was the father of one of them. Crouch had previously lit Diane's hair on fire and kicked her downstairs while she was pregnant. He got away with that and more because his aunt Colette Crouch was the clerk of courts. On April 2nd, Diane argued with Crouch over the phone about visitation, and she told him she was taking the kids and leaving the apartment. They wouldn't be there if he showed up. Crouch later arrived at the apartment in a car without a car seat for his infant son. He clearly saw that my car was gone, so he knew Diane and the kids were not there. Also, he had a stomach full of alcohol, so unless he planned to toss his infant son in the trunk and swerve down the highway, he wasn't there to pick up children he knew were not there. Police later claimed he didn't break into my apartment. Police photos of the shredded door frame, the deadbolt plate ripped loose from the screws, door shrapnel strewn all over the floor, and a boot print visible on the outside of the door didn't surface until 4 years later. After he kicked in my door, Crouch yelled that he would blow my head off and reached behind his back. In a panic, I stabbed him several times. Police claimed he was not armed, but they also said there was no break-in. He was the nephew of the clerk of courts. They life-flighted his dead body 3 counties away. Dr. Elizabeth Blaraki testified that I ambushed Crouch from behind until another coroner looked over the case and threatened to expose her fraud. And then she admitted we faced one another the whole time, just as I had always said. Diane Cisneros said I wrote a book about how to kill people and that she disposed of my grenade in the lake. Police had my writings and no such book existed. They sent divers down for a grenade and found hubcaps and beer cans, but that didn't stop Diane from testifying. A year to the day after my false conviction, Diane Cisneros lit her mom's house on fire while her mom slept in a back room. She said demons made her do it, and she never spent a day in prison. So if you want to learn a get-rich scheme, develop a dead body, or hear a weird take on Jesus, get with Demon Diane on Facebook, but keep her away from the gasoline and matches while you're sleeping. But the most crucial testimony came from Amy Peters, who said she saw Crouch arrive at my apartment at a time when other witnesses who knew him place crouch at least 10 minutes away from my apartment. Amy claimed she saw a shadowy figure in an upstairs window lure Crouch up to the apartment, and the 20 minutes passed before the ambulance arrived. Remember, the state said I was a murderous lunatic. Demon Diane said so. The state said I lured Crouch to the apartment to pick up his kids without a car seat in his car. They said there was no break-in since cops concealed photos proving otherwise. And they said I ambushed Crouch from behind until the coroner got caught lying. So with the 20-minute gap that Amy Peters accounted, the state said I lured Crouch to the apartment and kept him bleeding for 20 minutes before calling for help. Two problems here. First, Amy could see around buildings and into dark second-story buildings through insulation, plastic, and rain condensation, and, according to her testimony, through closed curtains and blinds. Amy Peters didn't see anything in any window, even if it had happened, and it didn't. Second, Crouch had alcohol in his stomach but not in his bloodstream, which means he died within 5 minutes of drinking that alcohol. Experts said so. That means we have to discount Amy Peters' 20-minute window unless we believe that 15 minutes after being fatally stabbed, Crouch laid on my floor washing down what appears to be a burger and fries with a bottle of liquor. I think it goes without saying that didn't happen. 5 minutes before he died, Crouch slugged down alcohol. He arrived at my apartment without a car seat because he wasn't picking up his infant son. As withheld police photos show, he left a boot print on my door and wood fragments on my floor. We were face to face and I stabbed him in a panic. I called for help immediately. Self-defense, not murder. That was 23 years ago. I've been held 8,168 consecutive days and counting. For more about my case and my struggle for freedom, go to SeanSwain.org or Free Sean Swain on Facebook or email me at 243205sean@gmail.com. This is John Zerzan reading a statement for anarchist prisoner Sean Swain at Ohio Supermax Facility. If you can't hear the sound of Sean's voice, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain number 243-205 OSP 878 Coitsville-Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio 44505. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org.
We're speaking with Will Munger, a member of Life During Wartime Editing Collective. The book is a product of the counterinsurgency convergence that occurred last year in Portland, Oregon. It's due to be published in early 2013 by AK Press. So counterinsurgency is a very big topic. Can you define the term?
I think to understand counterinsurgency, we have to understand how military and police think about insurgency. And so in 2006, the U.S. Army released a field manual, FM-324, as the U.S. was engaged in a counterinsurgency in Iraq and Afghanistan. And they defined insurgency as an organized movement aimed at the overthrow of a constituted government through the use of subversion and armed conflict. Stated another way, insurgency is an organized, protracted political military struggle designed to weaken the control and legitimacy of an established government occupying power or other political authority while increasing insurgent control. So the definition of counterinsurgency logically follows that counterinsurgency is the military, paramilitary, political, economic, psychological, and civic actions taken by a government to defeat insurgency.
How has counterinsurgency been applied, and how has it changed over time in international and domestic application?
Well, counterinsurgency really started during the colonial experience. In my own research, which involves the relationship between counterinsurgency and gangs, we see it go back to the Mau Mau Rebellion in Kenya during the 1950s. And the use of counterinsurgency against the Kikuyu population, who was uprising against British colonial authority, generated a lot of kind of the initial theory for people like Frank Kitson, who then went on in the United States at some RAND Corporation conferences to really transfer a lot of that knowledge into the United States. Of course, the U.S. had its own experience with counterinsurgency in Vietnam, and though what we see happening is this kind of transfer back and forth between the periphery of a colonial power or an empire, and then bringing that back into the internal metropolis and the counterinsurgents being used by domestic security apparatus, and most notably the police. And a really interesting pattern happened in the United States in the last 40 years, where when it got transferred back into the United States, local police really kind of took up the task of perfecting a lot of the techniques and tactics of it. A particularly interesting example, I think, is LAPD's community policing. So it's one thing we see happening in the mid-2000s when the U.S. was trying to re-engage a counterinsurgency strategy for Iraq, is, you know, the Marines embedding their officers within LAPD gang units because the techniques were so transferable to the situation that was happening in Iraq at that time. And so really in the last 10 years, we've seen kind of a refocus on counterinsurgency as a style and strategy of warfare.
What was the purpose of the counterinsurgency convergence? And what are you trying to do with this book?
The purpose of this project is to really engage a conversation in U.S. Movements and communities of resistance about what is counterinsurgency, how does it affect us, and how does it affect the political and social terrain. So the essays in the book are coming from people who are engaged in on-the-ground movement work, groups fighting gang injunctions, groups fighting for political prisoners. And it also comes from the perspective of academics who have been critically researching counterinsurgency over the last several years, everything from the relationship between translation and counterinsurgency to anthropology and counterinsurgency. And so really what we hope to do is provoke a larger critical conversation about how our context and work is being changed by domestic counterinsurgency.
So let's talk for a minute about the overlaps between social sciences and counterinsurgency initiatives of the police and the military. There's been a good deal of writing by social scientists, whether they be anthropologists or ethnographers or what have you, sociologists, about their role within the military as a questionable role, actively engaging with institutions of power like this. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, to really understand why the military needs social scientists, you know, anthropologists, sociologists, et cetera, it's really important to understand what counterinsurgency is targeting. In conventional war, you know, if we think of like World War II, the enemy's center of gravity was its ability to reproduce kind of its industrial machinery to actually fight the war. So to destroy the enemy's center of gravity is to bomb oil infrastructure or the ability to manufacture tanks, et cetera, state-on-state warfare. In counterinsurgency, the center of gravity or the target of counterinsurgency operations is much different. It's the population's perceived legitimacy for political control. And so to do that, the terrain is a little different. And so you have the development of this term that's called the human terrain, right, which is kind of the perception that the population feels for state legitimacy or colonial legitimacy or police legitimacy or who's ever fighting that sort of thing. And so we see this in Iraq and Afghanistan, where the U.S.'s initial shock and awe strategy, which aimed to destroy the Iraqi military, really failed to prevent the insurgency that emerged post-invasion. And so the development of the counterinsurgency field manual, as well as the human terrain teams, were really a result of the U.S. recalibrating its strategy to move from state-on-state warfare to more counterinsurgent warfare that targeted a population. And so the role that people like anthropologists play in these sort of conflicts is a mediating one, right? So a human terrain team specialist will be embedded in a platoon, and you know they'll be drinking tea with local elders. They'll be trying to map particular networks and that emerge in that are existent within the population and could emerge as an insurgent network. But the U.S. is trying to then kind of capture those sort of social relationships and bring those into a counterinsurgent apparatus. It's been described and really celebrated by liberals as this kind of gentler, more humane, what they call graduate-level style of warfare. But I think, you know, any kind of hard look at the reality of war proves that it's not a gentler sort of warfare, but it is one that has a different target in mind and has a different kind of strategic orientation. And so the mapping of that human terrain really comes as a central imperative of those social scientists who are working with the military.
you said that those who are formulating the solutions frame the questions. Let's briefly look at the salad bowl. What does Salinas look like to you? What does it look like to the Salinas Police Department? And can it be considered a test case for a larger application?
Sure. Well, let me give a little context to what's happening in Salinas. So in Salinas, which is in Central California, the Naval Postgraduate School, which is a really high-level military research institution, has partnered with the Salinas Police and the Salinas government to try to apply counterinsurgency against gangs. And so the reason that I was particularly interested in this is that this is one of the first instances where the both the police and politicians are just very explicit that they're using counterinsurgency strategy, techniques, and technologies against the domestic population. I think sometimes, you know, it's easy to think of it as, you know, just like overarching conspiracy, but in reality, counterinsurgency is happening in a very decentralized way, where kind of local institutions and partner with national-level institutions to adapt some of these counterinsurgency tactics and strategies. And so what I was interested in Salinas is how do they plan their operation? What sort of information and what sort of knowledges are they interested in? What are their targets? How do they think about what they're doing? And so I began researching it by finding declassified reports that naval postgraduate researchers were writing. These are, you know, available online. They're pretty easy to get a hold of, and they're really dense. It's some serious social science academics that they're doing. You know, they're looking at the political and economic factors that define Salinas. They're looking at how the Latino population in East Salinas is kind of constituted and their relationship with the police and the kind of historical factors that play into that. And so what I was really interested in is how the counterinsurgents are thinking about that population and what Salinas looks like to them.
Let's talk about how the mind of the counterinsurgency-trained cop or Fed or military officer or data analyst works. Would it be true to say that there's an amped-up thin blue line mentality, viewing the world in terms of perpetual chaos and entropy with enemies in all the shadows, oftentimes taking the forms of the nation's own citizenry?
I think there's two ways to approach that question. Counterinsurgency as a theory has some particular assumptions about how society works. So if we think about this in contrast to older ideas of repression, particularly embodied in Hoover, say COINTELPRO, J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI director long ago, it was a conspiratorial one. And right, and this is because they were reading Lenin, they were reading Mao, and they had this idea that insurgency happened in this very organized way where the insurgents got together, formed a people's army or conspiratorial cell, and then launched an attack on the state, hoping to overthrow it. And so the task of the repressive apparatus of the state was to root out that sort of conspiracy. But there was this assumption that larger society as a whole worked. Right, counterinsurgency is more based on the assumption about society that's in constant conflict, that there's always going to be insurgents out there. There's always a small level of insurgency, and so the task is to preemptively intervene in a population to deactivate that insurgency before it happens. And the best organization to do that is the police, because the police ostensibly have more legitimacy than a military apparatus in terms of being able to preemptively survey the population that might be predisposed to insurgency or rebellious activity. And then the second way to answer this question in terms of what is going through the mind of these counterinsurgents is really to think about community policing. You know, people like Christian Williams have made the hypothesis that militarization of the police, you know, SWAT teams, that sort of thing, plus community policing is really what's at the core of counterinsurgency. And that's because in the mind of the counterinsurgents, it's incredibly important to make connections with the local population that involve trust, that involve legitimacy, and that involve information sharing. Right? And so what's going through the mind of, you know, say, people in Salinas who are trying to apply this sort of counterinsurgency is how do we develop the legitimacy of the local police? Right, and you do this through putting community policing officers in social centers and family centers, and then trying to develop decentralized intelligence gathering networks that kind of grow into the population and that allow for a greater information flow in order to map networks that are previously invisible to those counterinsurgents. So it's not a particular conspiracy that they're going for, but a constant conspiracy, one of constant social conflict that they're constantly managing to the point where capital accumulation or the reproduction of status, social relationships really happens.
Mr. Williams has been involved in a group called Rose City Cop Watch for a number of years, helped to found it, and it's an abolitionist cop watch with, it seems like, a sort of goal of creating a counterpower to police in communities. How does this relate to, is this a one model for how we might resist these sort of tendencies in law enforcement?
Well, I don't want to speak for Cop Watch in particular, but I would say that initiatives around the United States and other places around the world that really try to figure out how do we take care of ourselves without police and without prisons is one of the most important, I think, questions and problematics to come out of research into counterinsurgency. The question of care without the state and in conflict with the state, I think, can take a lot of different sort of manifestations. And the work that the Cop Watch is doing does in terms of trying to question the legitimacy of the police, but also, like you said, create that kind of counter pole or kind of dual power or separate pole of legitimacy. Certainly, I think reflects a lot of research into counterinsurgency.
On another note, the hacker group Anonymous, alongside WikiLeaks and a few other groupings, just announced Operation Trapwire. To quote from Anonymous's press release on the project, this weekend it was disclosed by WikiLeaks the details about a system known as Trapwire that uses facial recognition and other techniques, including high-end artificial intelligence, to track and monitor individuals using countless different closed-circuit cameras operated by cities and other institutions, including private businesses. This program also monitors all social media on the internet. Can you talk about this in terms of human terrain sciences?
Sure. I think it's really easy to sometimes kind of get caught up in the specter of all this high technology that's happening right now, whether it's the application of drones domestically or these really high-level kind of social media monitoring and mining sort of softwares. And it's also really important when considering that to think about what's the political logic behind this sort of thing. And I think that helps us see this Trapwire is not necessarily unique. It is not that different than something that's been happening a lot. And one example of this is in L.A., and L.A. was named in the anonymous communique as one of the cities that's participating in this. Trapwire is only part of a larger surveillance apparatus that's being built right now under the auspices of what's called Special Order 1, which is a policy directive initiated by LAPD Chief Charlie Beck. And this is also part of what's called the Suspicious Activity Reporting Database. The idea behind both the camera surveillance and suspicious activity reporting, which kind of monitors kind of day-to-day behavior, observed behavior that might cue for criminality or give the police an idea of who might be the potential insurgent, terrorist, gang member, et cetera, is, again, this larger emphasis on the monitoring preemptively of populations that could be predisposed to revolt, uprising, insurgency, et cetera. The ability to track people's facial traits or gaits or these kind of smaller aspects, I think, are again part of this larger kind of political shift that happens in kind of a counterinsurgent logic.
So let's talk about the implications of counterinsurgency as applied to radical political movements in the United States currently. Anarchism, for example, and its varied tendencies can motivate actions of many types. Organizations affiliated with it can look like many different things, and goals to be achieved are diverse, both regionally and philosophically. So you've got Food Not Bombs, and then you've got the Earth Liberation Front, or you've got Earth First, and you've got the Wobblies. How has counterinsurgency been brought down on our communities, and where do you see this going?
I think I'd shy away from describing counterinsurgency's impact on our communities as a monolithic, conspiratorial specter. Right? It's, say fusion centers or, joint terrorism task force really integrate the ability of local, state, and national law enforcement to gather intelligence on our communities and to engage in attacks on our communities. There is still a degree of autonomy within local forces that oftentimes are contingent on local political conditions or relationships that kind of set up how those conflicts emerge. You know, one really obvious place that I would call attention to is what's happening in the Pacific Northwest right now, which is kind of a coordinated attack on anarchists across the Northwest. Most recently, the raids and grand jury subpoenas that have happened. There's kind of been a smaller part of that story where in the actual raids themselves, you know, they were not just serving subpoenas, but they were looking for anarchist literature. They were going through people's phones and computers and really trying to put together a picture of a network that is not necessarily immediately visible. And I think that understanding the role of something like grand juries is not just a tool of a criminal nature trying to prosecute a particular criminal case, but really is a fishing expedition to try to understand more about an anarchist community and resistance movement that doesn't necessarily organize itself on kind of classical leftist lines of being an above-ground or underground movement with a clearly defined hierarchy. And I think that counterinsurgency is set up to combat decentralized movements. And so I think there is a problematic that exists for anarchist movements right now to think about what are the strategies, techniques, and technologies that the state is engaging against us in our own local political context, and what does that mean for the terrain that our resistance happens on.
And what are some good ways for people who are thinking along these lines to start that thinking, to start working on those problematics?
Well, I mean, one way to think about this is the question of legitimacy. And I, in the Northwest right now, I think it's really inspiring to see how a really broad cross-sector of a lot of different movements is coming out in support of the people that are being targeted by the grand jury. In the Black during wartime, we have a really awesome article by the Wild Poppies Collective, who was involved in support for the RNC8, who were a group of anarchists that were targeted with conspiracy to riot and furtherance of terrorism after the Republican National Convention in 2008. And one of the real lessons that they learned is that having a broad-based community support that really stands behind people in the face of a police strategy that's trying to isolate them, to move them in a direction where they're not getting that community support, that sort of mobilizing that generates legitimacy and generates the sort of support for the people targeted really puts anarchists in a stronger position than if anarchists allow themselves to be isolated.
How do agencies dabbling in counterinsurgency praxis view social needs in communities such as health, employment, education, and security in terms of legitimacy and in terms of population control?
Well, I think there's a really interesting contradiction within counterinsurgency and within a larger kind of political economic system known as neoliberalism. And we really see this in Iraq, right, where right after the shock and awe campaigns, you have, within the Bremer-led constitution, this intense privatization of the former Ba'athist state and really kind of the slicing up and destruction of a lot of state welfare institutions. And when the surge came around in 2006, what was really noted is the need to have an integrated state apparatus where the social services were bound up in the intelligence gathering apparatuses that were also looking for networks of insurgents that were hiding amongst the population. And so when we see something like the counterinsurgency initiative in Salinas targeting a Latino population, ostensibly under the auspices of targeting gangs, we see they use this thing called cross-functional teams. And cross-functional teams are these regular meetings between social service providers, probation and parole, parks and recreation, as well as police, and are trying to think about how they can combine the spectrum of activities that the state engages in to try to shape the population's behavior in a particular way that prevents gang formation, that prevents the formation of networks that the counterinsurgents are not excited about having exist. So you see the contradiction where, on one hand, a larger political system of neoliberalism wants to privatize a lot of those state functions, but a counterinsurgent logic suggests that those institutions are necessary as part of a way to legitimate state power. And so it's kind of unclear how that contradiction will be resolved, although we do see counterinsurgency used in the process of a lot of neoliberal attacks such as Iraq.
So how has the connection between nonprofits and the surveillance infrastructure in Salinas panned out?
Well, again, I think that, you know, despite that counterinsurgency is a theory and practice that is becoming more widespread in U.S. security institutions and apparatuses, it's not uniform. It's not all across the board. Not every single nonprofit, not every single city service considers itself as part of a counterinsurgent apparatus. And I think a lot of people that work in those institutions would really object to them being considered as part of that. That being said, the way that MPS researchers and city officials and police in Salinas see those institutions and organizations are as part of this full spectrum approach that deepens intelligence gathering networks within the population and also plays a role to legitimize the police in the face of a population that doesn't have a lot of legitimacy for police. So in Salinas, which is a really cash-strapped city on both the police and municipal government, the big counterinsurgent initiative is really putting two community policing officers in the Hebron Heights Community Center and Family Center through what's called the Weed and Seed Initiative. And, when I went to Salinas and were interviewing kids at that family center, they actually really liked the community policing officers. You know, they thought that they, you know, cared about their problems, that they were there in the neighborhood, making life better for them. And that's one of kind of these contradictions within counterinsurgency that, or at least its domestic application, is that while the overall praxis as it's engaged both nationally and internationally is often is pretty much across the board about maintaining political control in a particular way, the way it's being used in Salinas is all about preventing violence and, you know, who can be against preventing violence. But I think the real question is why that violence exists, what social and political and economic conditions that comes from, and ultimately what counterinsurgency does is prevent any sort of fundamental social change happening from below in a way that displaces a prison society and a police state society and an economy based on capitalist agribusiness in a place like Salinas.
Keeping with Salinas for the moment, another interesting part of your chapter on Salinas was the section talking about every abuelita a censor. Can you talk about that program a little bit?
Yeah, sure. This was one of the vision of an ex police chief, Liz Featheroff, and his idea was to incorporate Hispanic grandmothers as part of this counterinsurgent apparatus, such that because abuelitas play a significant social role in Latino culture and have a lot of sway over children, and oftentimes are kind of the run a lot of the household. That if the police could incorporate these grandmothers into their intelligence gathering network and their state legitimizing network, then they would make a big play. Obviously, that didn't pan out for some reason. The grandmothers in Salinas are a little skeptical of police, probably because both their sons and grandsons and daughters and granddaughters have been subjected to really awful police violence and don't hold a lot of legitimacy for the police. So that initiative at this point has failed. And it's something that Naval Postgraduate School researchers noted did fail.
We're speaking with Will Munger, co-editor and contributor to the upcoming AK Press book, Life During Wartime, about domestic counterinsurgency praxis in the United States. We'll be right back after this musical break.
I think it's just simple. There's thousands of black cops in America, and you've never seen white folks have to march because some black cop have misused them. You never see no white people on TV say that black cop shot my son in the head 40 times. Now the question we ask, is that because we're more spiritual or better trained? No, black cops know white folks ain't gonna tolerate it. And when we stop tolerating, it stops.
When Marley Graham, they shot him. Allen Bluford, they shot him. Ken Chamberlain, they shot him. Kendrick McDade, they shot him. Derry Simmons, they shot him. Bo Morrison, they shot him. Wendell Allen, they shot him. Justin Sipp, they shot him. Scared rappers, be quiet. Scared preachers, be quiet. Scared leaders, be quiet. You in the presence of warriors. I said scared rappers, be quiet. Scared preachers, be quiet. Scared leaders, be quiet. You in the war with your face, boy. You can't call this a race war, cause we the only ones that got hate for, that get shot down when the gays war. But we always willing to take more, from Emmett Till on that lake floor to Trayvon, Rakia, boy, move me and
in Troy. Yes, we destroyed some public enemy. Y'all bring the noise. Marissa Alexander, they locked her. Jasmine Thar, they shot her. They keep trying to kill us, but they never get indicted. Our people crying loud, but these scared rappers stay quiet. And if we don't get justice, do we need to start a riot, huh? Do we need to start a riot? Need to start a riot? Do we need to start a riot? Need to start a riot? Do we need to start a riot? Need to start a riot? Do we need to start a riot? Need to start a riot?
My name is Henry Heath Watson, and we're at Florence and Normandy, Los Angeles, California. Today, rest in peace, Rodney King passed away. Here it is 20 years later. Like you said, stand our ground, y'all know what to do.
In 92, them riots blew. Peace treaty, red ice with blue. And now lay the Crips and the power rules. Put aside the fuse and start riding true. To the end, no, I was behind the two. The police came in to divide the crews. They steal a homie's car, then drive it through. Another gang soot, then fire the two. Our unity is our biggest weapon. When I ask the question, you feeling threatened. But imagine a child being killed for less than 45 days for the killers arrested. Mad at me cause I'm giving a message. But if we can get killed by Zimmermans, and they can get off cause of privilege, then all we really citizens get beaten to death. You an immigrant, go back to your country's a sentiment. They call us monkeys, say we ignorant. So if we get killed, they don't give a shit. Now what would you do if you was living this, to protect your kids from this? If your child got killed, would you live with it? Would you slit your wrist? Would you get the fifth? Would you care about the job or your benefits? If they said they murderer was innocent, no judge, no trial, no sentences. And you saw how foul this system is. But they keep telling us to be patient. They keep telling us to keep waiting. They keep telling us that we hating. And when we kill cause we black, that we racist. Hal Morgan, they shot him. Then for 40 years, they locked him. They keep trying to kill us, but they never get indicted. Our people crying loud, but these scared rappers stay quiet. And if we don't get justice, do we need to start a riot, huh? Do we need to start a riot? Need to start a riot? Do we need to start a riot? Need to start a riot? Do we need to start a riot? Need to start a riot? Do we need to start a riot? Need to start a riot?
We're speaking with Will Munger, co-editor and contributor to the upcoming AK Press book, Life During Wartime, about domestic counterinsurgency praxis in the United States. So it seems like this topic is a great opportunity to engage with people, people outside of the anarchist circles who have been impacted by the application of COIN strategy and practice. You've mentioned the organizing around gang injunctions in California. And in Greensboro, North Carolina, there's been anarchists who have been working to support the almighty Latin Kings and Queens Nation as they face charges of racketeering from the federal authorities. What are some other points of contact that could be exploited by activists?
You know, I think, you know, from what I gather of what's going on in Greensboro, I was thinking that about how anarchist experience in resisting grand juries can really translate and be useful to other communities who are facing those sort of attacks, and in the case of grand juries in the Midwest a couple years ago, as well as the ones out in the Pacific Northwest right now, they're really kind of intelligence gathering operations as much as they are about pursuing particular criminal charges. When you have a politicized street organization like the Almighty Latin Kings and Queens, the state's ability to kind of monitor preemptively and survey those populations and those kind of diffuse networks, I think, you know, we can relate based on a common experience of facing police violence and facing a prison system that is pretty pervasive. And similarly, I think that we can think about, you know, initiatives like the Demographics Unit or Special Order 1 and the Suspicious Activity Reporting Databases in New York and LA, respectively, as these kind of sites in which counterinsurgency becomes very obvious. It's very present, but we don't necessarily have a vocabulary to talk about the connections between the militarization of police and the use of community policing and the use of, you know, moss crawlers in New York, or these tripwire and suspicious activity reporting in LA. But I think we need to develop a language in which to talk about the larger strategic context in which we're working in, which I think is one that is well defined by counterinsurgency. But, you know, it's unclear what, you know, real affinities can develop out of that common experience. But I think it's definitely one worth questioning and worth trying to see if relationships can come up. One anarchist initiative that I'm pretty excited about right now is the publication Down that came out of Indiana. where people are really trying to think about, you know, what is the relationship between people on the outside and people on the inside in terms of supporting prison rebellion, both on the inside and outside. And, you know, having that common experience of either being held in CMUs, being subjected to segregated housing units, which was one of the big causes of the California prison strike. These common experiences certainly create a context for relationships, but I think that I've seen only a few anarchist initiatives that really try to build a relationship, and, you know, those relationships often take a lot of time and are really difficult. But, you know, efforts like the one in Greensboro to support the ALKQN as well as Down, I think, are really cool steps in the right direction.
Strategic Communication is the title of an essay by Hy Rothstein in the Naval Postgraduate Studies Program book, Gangs and Guerrillas. It's also a theoretical tool for influencing civilian populations and social movements. How is this different from PSYOPs, and how do we see the framing of narratives involved in strategic communication in our media?
Sure. So the term PSYOPs, which refers to psychological operations, is really losing a lot of steam in the military. I think they kind of just evaluated that term and decided it was more baggage than it was worth, although it's still used in some segments. But the title of one of the Naval postgraduate research papers about Salinas is all about this idea of information superiority. Who has the most information flows coming in, and how can the police maximize those in a population where that population has low levels of legitimacy for the police and are not giving them a lot of information about what goes down on the streets? So strategic communications is more than just a fancy word for propaganda, right? It also really emphasizes the relational and organizational building that happens between the state, the police, the municipal government, and local community organizations or informal networks, and really trying to I think the best term here is one of interpolation, right, where the state is trying to bring forth the population to act in a particular way, saying, you know, we want you to be a strategic partner with us to prevent violence in your neighborhood. And to do that, you should, particular community representatives, respected leaders should sit on these advisory boards, should be part of these, you know, anti-gang efforts. And so strategic communications then has those leaders, passing on the logic of these sort of larger initiatives, but also are creating different sort of networks that can feed information back into a police surveillance apparatus.
We've mentioned fusion centers in the United States. Can you talk a little about what these are and other forms of private/corporate security infrastructure that are parts of the domestic counterinsurgency frameworks?
Well, fusion centers are places where local, state, and national law enforcement can coordinate and share intelligence. And these are present at national security events like the Republican National Convention, the Democratic National Convention. During the 2010 Olympics, the Fusion Center was built on the U.S.-Canadian border. And so we're seeing these pop up all over the place. And the logic of them, I think, you can see really play out in recent Joint Terrorism Task Force raids in the Northwest, where the intelligence collected by local police is also fed into these fusion centers and then distributed to other agencies that are working on particular politicized cases. You know, in the United States, ostensibly we don't have a national police force, but through the creation of these fusion centers, there is the building of this capability to act in a more coordinated way. Although a lot of times the fusion centers don't necessarily use the term counterinsurgency, and a lot of times the fusion centers are also less invested in the particular community policing aspects that are really central to counterinsurgency theory. In places like LA, I think that we see a lot of kind of development of those sort of ideas, and kind of combining fusion centers with local community policing is a little more common than other places.
In the neoliberal world that we inhabit, how does counterinsurgency look when it's applied by the private sector?
One thing that we've been seeing recently, and the comments that I'm citing are specifically coming from a natural gas drilling conference that was happening in Houston where a character from Range Resources was talking about how important it is for fracking companies to be looking at counterinsurgency and looking at the counterinsurgency field manual because they're faced with this, you know, environmental insurgency. And I think this specter of an environmental insurgency, we've seen that come up a couple different places. One really notable example that we heard about is the MARDEX War Games exercises. And we found out about this from an anthropologist named John Allison, who's part of the human terrain system. And when he was being trained in Kansas, the scenario that he was assigned to was an action in Lakeland, which is an imaginary secessionist state in northeastern Kansas. And in this training scenario, human terrain teams are sent into Lakeland in response to unrest, specifically anti-coal actions by the Sierra Clubs and more radical groups encouraging the Earth Liberation Front. And human terrain team students were assigned the following tasks: to find out details about the criminal activity, to find out the best conduits in which to pass information that would be psychological operations and information operations to the local population, and last, to produce a research plan that understands the situation at this power plant, people's concerns, desires, and identify those who are the problem solvers with those who are the problem causers, and the rest of the population who would be the target of information operations to move their center of gravity towards that set of viewpoints and values, which is the desired end state of the military strategy. And so what you see here is this idea that the population is ultimately the target of counterinsurgent operations, and that they're trying to isolate the more radical elements by trying to engage the more moderate elements to give up those more radical elements and try to come to a solution that works for everyone except those who are really fighting for a very different world. What we've seen in places like the Marcellus Shell, where fracking is incredibly controversial, is the development of these sort of kind of astroturf groups that really kind of front as, you know, representing local opinion, representing kind of local interests, but really trying to intervene in anti-fracking struggles in a way that isolates the elements that, the more radical elements that are calling for just a complete halt to fracking operations. It's unclear, how much collaboration is happening, say, between fusion centers or between these private enterprises, but certainly counterinsurgency is entering the political imagination of a lot of resource extraction companies that are faced with significant resistance.
Can you talk briefly about the importance of surviving outside of the system while facing a counterinsurgency?
I think that this is where, resistance becomes survival and survival becomes resistance, where a lot of undocumented folks, and I think Arizona is a perfect example of this right now, after SB 1070, these are populations that can't rely on the state. They can't rely on social services provided by the state because those social services are brought into immigration enforcement where, you don't even know if, you're applying for food stamps if, that food stamps is your ticket out of the country because ICE is going to then, come to your home, And so I think this question, again, of how do we take care of ourselves and our communities outside of the state is an imperative that exists and one that is not, I don't think we have a lot of experience in doing that. And so initiatives that try to address that question, I think, hold a lot of potential.
So in your chapter, you include the quote, "Unlike the modern state, empire does not deny the existence of civil war. Instead, it manages it." And that's a quote from Introduction to Civil War by Tikkun. And you follow that with a statement saying, "This critique is an important counterpoint to proposals emanating from institutions like NPS, or the Naval Postgraduate Studies, which commensurate gangs and insurgents." Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, one thing I think that's interesting, at least about the Naval Postgraduate School, those folks are reading Tikkun. They're citing The Coming Insurrection as a text that they're paying attention to. But less than, I think what's less important is kind of the theoretical posturing of it all, but more this idea that that society is at a constant state of war right now, and that there are fault lines and divisions that are sites of constant conflict, and the job of the security apparatus is not to criminally prosecute those that are crossing boundaries and causing problems, but there's a real imperative to manage that social war and that conflict in a way that allows capital accumulation and state legitimation to move forward. But there isn't this assumption that the good citizens will prevail and that democracy will be this forward-marching, inevitable process, but that the best they can do is manage that civil war to the point where it's manageable.
What might counterpower models other than the Copwatch that we talked about earlier look like? How can we uncloak coin strategies and counteract them in our organizing and take away from their legitimacy?
If I had the answer for you, it'd be all over, right? I really don't have the answer. I don't know. I think a good first step is, in any art of war, is to know your enemy. And I think that what we're trying to do with this Left During Wartime project is to really try to ask the question of what is counterinsurgency? How does it affect the political and social terrain? And I think you're going to get really different answers depending on who you ask, and there's not going to be one way of moving forward to this, but I think a good first step is to understand the strategies, technologies, and techniques of counterinsurgency, and I think that's a good first step.
In his introduction to the book, Christian Williams talks about the Rand Corporation's definitions of three stages of revolutions and counter-revolutions, those being 1, proto-insurgency, 2, small-scale insurgency, and 3, major insurgency. What is the United States viewing the current state as? Does the domestic law enforcement view us as being in a proto-insurgency, or is that just a perpetual state?
Well, I think it depends on who you ask. I think there's the fiction that the state tells about itself and the fiction that various state agencies and actors tell about themselves. Then there's the reality of what they do, right? And oftentimes those are in conflict with each other. There's a contradiction that runs throughout that. The proto-insurgency and major insurgency and small insurgency is all about this idea of scale and measured response. Right, so again, the political imagination of a counterinsurgency is one in which insurgency is a constant part of society, it's a constant background noise, and it's a constant possibility that always has to be managed for. And so the best way to do that when it's a proto-insurgency is through a security apparatus that holds ostensibly high levels of legitimacy, and that would be the police force. But I think it's no shock to any anarchist that once a police force loses any sort of significant legitimacy, that you're going to see an escalation of the security apparatus and move into kind of a military direction. But the important thing about the scaled idea is that you're going to see a different sort of response depending on what insurgency looks like. The lesson that I think we can take out of that is that the police are at constant war with elements of society that have the potential to rebel. And so the idea that police could be part of the 99%, if the 99% is serious about any significant challenges to the capital of the state, is just completely absurd from an institutional perspective.
Bringing it back around to social scientists in the military, how do you see that relationship moving forward?
Whether we're talking about trying to incorporate, Latino grandmothers into a counterinsurgent apparatus, or they're talking about trying to incorporate anthropologists into this counterinsurgent apparatus, a possibility for resistance that exists very tangibly is just the refusal to participate in intelligence gathering operations, the refusal to participate in anything that legitimizes these sort of security institutions and forces. And within anthropology, there's significant resistance to the human terrain team. Groups like the Network of Concerned Anthropologists have been releasing statements and fighting against this for a really long time. The military is actually having a hell of a time trying to recruit anthropologists because so many anthropology students get it, and they get that it's not a kinder, gentler war, that they're just part of a more advanced idea of how to dominate and control the human terrain. And so the refusal to participate in these sort of institutions, I think, is another really important step.
Yeah, definitely.
Although a bit obvious, maybe.
Thank you so much for speaking with us, Will.
And yeah, my pleasure. Thank you for...
We've been speaking with Will Munger. Will is a co-editor and contributor to the upcoming AK Press book, Life During Wartime, about what counterinsurgency is, how it works, and how it affects movements in the United States. Past episodes of the show can be found online at www.archive.org by searching the terms BURSTS Bursts Final Straw. Asheville Free Media, AshevilleFM.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm your host, Bursts of Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, and KWTF in Santa Rosa, California. The Final Straw is supported by the worker owners at Firestorm Books and Cafe at 48 Commerce Street in downtown Asheville, North Carolina. Firestorm features organic coffee and milks, vegan sandwiches, homemade baked goods, radical literature, and a community calendar that can be found online at www.firestormcafe.com. Have a great week.
Dressed like housewives, or in a suit and a tie.